on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a look at World War II and the skies over Europe today through the eyes of 90-year-old Duke O'Donnell. He served as a bombardier with the Hell's Angels of the 303rd Bomb Group, the 358th Squadron, flying B-17s out of Molesworth, England. I say through his eyes, but those eyes almost didn't exist after December 31st, 1944. We're going to get Duke's memories of that day, but first, a little time-traveling but relevant detour for you. I've been blessed to interview World War II veterans on a weekly basis for more than 10 years now, starting out with a series on local television in Fresno, California. And one of the first veterans that I had the chance to sit down with was a bomber pilot named Bill McLeod. A couple years later, when Hometown Heroes hit the airwaves, I had Bill on this show. And we're going to tap into the archives because one of the most memorable parts of Bill's story came when he remembered the brave actions of his bombardier, a teenager from Illinois named Duke O'Donnell. If you'd like to hear that entire interview with the late Bill McLeod, it's linked at hometownheroesradio.com. But here's how he described the events of December 31st, 1944, in a bombing mission targeting Neuss, Germany.
At that time, all of our missions were to help the soldiers on the ground during the Battle of the Bulge. We wanted to destroy the facilities that they had there behind the lines where they were bringing in their supplies. So that was our target. And it was a tiny little target. It wasn't real big. But what amazed me was the accuracy of the anti-aircraft. As we came in, we could see the anti-aircraft exploding ahead of us. And it was right at our altitude. They would be getting closer and closer. And finally, they were in the formation. And that's where my bombardier got the Purple Heart, because some slivers of steel exploded and came into the nose of the airplane. And by the way, bombardiers were more casualties than any other position on the airplane. Anyway, he got hit with exploding plexiglass, which got into his eyes and his head. He wouldn't leave his position. He stayed there until it was time for bombs away, and we told him when to drop the bombs, and he flipped the switch. And then we took him back to the radio room where he received first aid. But we could hear the flak hitting the airplane. It was like gravel, throwing a handful of gravel at the plane. Fortunately, we just had one Purple Heart, and that was the only Purple Heart in all of my missions that I flew.
So he has plexiglass in his eyes, can't see a thing.
Yeah.
And
blood is flowing into his eyes.
But he didn't leave his station. He stayed right there.
He wouldn't evacuate. We tried to get him to leave, but he wouldn't. By the way, his name was Duke O'Donnell, and he was from Joliet, Illinois.
What did that mean to you when he refused to leave and was determined to stay there and fulfill his duty? Was that inspirational to you?
It had to be inspirational, and I was very much admired Duke for that. And I put him in for a medal after we got down. And then it was turned down. And later on in life, I got him the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Which, for those who aren't familiar, is one of the more prestigious awards that you can earn flying for the U.S. military.
And that was in addition to the Purple Heart.
So we got a Purple Heart and a DFC, and the respect of his crew, certainly. And you probably can't think of too many instances. I imagine we couldn't get too many stories if we put a survey out there of blind bombardiers who hit their targets.
Well, that's very true. As a matter of fact, we had one in our group, a bombardier, who practically did the same thing, and he got the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Hmm.
That was earlier before we got there. And they named an airfield after him in West Texas.
That was a young man named Jack Mathis, like Bill said, serving in that same bomb group, the 303rd. And the Medal of Honor citation for Jack Mathis reads, "His right arm was shattered above the elbow, a large wound was torn in his side and abdomen, and he was knocked from his bomb site to the rear of the bombardier's compartment. Realizing that the success of the mission depended on him, First Lieutenant Mathis, by sheer determination and willpower, though mortally wounded, dragged himself back to his sights, released his bombs, then died at his post of duty." As the result of this action, the airplanes of his bombardment squadron placed their bombs directly upon the assigned target for a perfect attack against the enemy. First Lieutenant Mathis's undaunted bravery has been a great inspiration to the officers and men of his unit. So that's from the citation for the late Jack Mathis's Medal of Honor, a medal that's on display at the National Museum of the Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. You heard Bill McLeod mention an airfield was named after him. That's Mathis Municipal Airport in San Angelo, Texas. And it's actually named after Jack Mathis and his brother Mark Mathis together, because when that plane landed, Mark Mathis was there at the base as a member of that same bomb group. He asked to take his brother Jack's spot on the crew. He did, and less than 2 months later, Mark, too, was killed in action over the North Sea. Can you imagine what a sacrifice that family made? I have some links about that at hometownheroesradio.com. Quite a legacy with brave bombardiers in the 303rd Bomb Group. And Duke O'Donnell might have been just inches away from having a similar story to tell. I hope you're following all the twists and turns here. I know we're bouncing around. But now that we've gone back in the archives to hear his pilot tell the story of Duke O'Donnell's Purple Heart, let's get Duke's version. Your first mission was December 29th of 44. Your second mission was December 30th. Everybody celebrates every New Year's Eve, but they're probably celebrating something different from what you celebrate on New Year's Eve. Tell me about December 31st of 44 from beginning to end. How did that day start?
Well, we went to briefing, of course, which is first before the mission, to find out about the target and any defenses they might have down there, how many guns, if they know how many guns they have. Anyway, so then we took off, got flown toward the target, and I started seeing flak, and they had three types of ways to shoot flak: straight at the plane, or what we call tracking flak, which is the most accurate. They shoot ahead of you, and on the bomberman you can't deviate from course, so you have to fly right into it. And that was the case in this case. I looked up, and they had either four gun batteries or six gun batteries. And up ahead, I saw one shell go off, and then another one closer, and another one closer, and I knew they had at least four, and I knew we were going to be right there when I got hit. So I even said over the intercom, we're going to get hit. And the next thing I knew, I thought my head was gone, the top of my head was gone. I just sat there waiting to die. didn't bother me a bit. So anyway, I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to die right away. I can get these bombs out. So I told Mac, I said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs. So I was able to feel around. I couldn't see because I had glass in my eye. And he said, there they go. So I felt the toggle switch, which you can get the bombs out that way. And so I got them out that way. And then I was really out of my head for the rest of the day. Maybe ever since, I don't know. But anyway, so Max says, go back to the radio room. So I couldn't see, so I got up, and the top turret gunner, the engineer, helped me along. And I thought to myself, I'll jump out of the plane to make it lighter. They can get back to England easier if I lighten the load up a little bit. You see how I was out of my head. So the engineer, DeWillers, took my parachute off. It was a chest pack, so I could get through the narrow catwalk to the radio room. And but I did have sense enough not to jump out without a parachute, huh? So anyway, I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors, but anyway. So we went back to the radio room, and then we had to make a forced landing. We thought there were no brakes. Mac did, the pilot. So we landed, and then they did finally have some brakes, so we were okay there. And then the ambulance came, take me to the hospital, and they'd say, like, was it a rough mission? And I'd try to make the right answer, but something like, it's going to rain next Tuesday or something would come out, you know. So I went to the hospital, and I think the next day I was okay. Of course, maybe the other guys say, I don't know. But anyway, so I stayed there a week in the hospital, and then came back. And I flew a couple of missions, and then they trained me as a GH navigator, which was it was a new invention by an Englishman. And they you'd have two radio signals, sending stations, about 100 miles apart right behind our lines, and each would send out a signal, and the plane would fly along one signal, and when it got to the other one, that was the target, so you dropped the bombs then.
And I want to talk some more about that, but I've got to retrace your steps a little bit. I didn't want to interrupt you because I wanted to hear the story from your perspective as you remember it, but people listening are saying, boy, this guy is describing this like it's no big deal. But the first thing you said was, all of a sudden, after you saw, you know, one piece of flak closer, another burst closer, you told everyone we're going to get hit. The next thing you know, you thought the top of your head was blown off. So this flak exploded right in the nose of the plane, knocked out the plexiglass, knocked it into your eyes, and you're blind, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. No, couldn't see. The plexiglass, of course, that all crumbled, you know, breaks up in little pieces. I have my face, my eye, and my nose.
So it's basically like buckshot going into your face, only plexiglass.
Yeah, right. That's about it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't see. You're feeling your face. You probably feel a lot of blood, and you really thought that half your head was blown off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But you stayed at your position to drop your bombs, and this is what your pilot, Bill McLeod, told me was so impressive that inspired the rest of your crew. They all wanted to take you back and give you medical attention. You said, no, I want to drop these bombs. But you're saying that wasn't necessarily a conscious thought, that you were pretty out of it.
You get so trained, I think, to it that dropping the bombs is the one thing you're thinking about. So you don't want to change your mind. You just want to get the bombs out and then figure out I wasn't too sensible either.
Did you ever find out how many pieces of plexiglass they pulled out of you?
No, I don't know. There were quite. There's still one in my nose, but it doesn't bother me any. And so I don't know how many they probably threw them away. I don't know.
So the one that's still in your nose, you can feel it internally, or you can rub your finger over it and feel it?
I can feel it right. I'm feeling it right now. Yeah, it's up in there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right inside of your left eye, there's a little spot on the bridge of your nose.
Right in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So at the time, you're still there in the bombardier position in the nose. Of course, the glass is shot out. Not that you could see it anyway. You're completely blind, and you needed help from your crew in order to know when to flip that switch and drop the bomb. So how did that work?
Well, I called Mac, the pilot, and said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs, because we were in formation. So when the other ones dropped their bombs, I was able to find this, what they call the toggle switch, and got them out that way.
You know, and Bill had never told me this part, because maybe he didn't know what was inside your head. He just told me about, you know, he wanted you to get a Distinguished Flying Cross for that. You did receive the Purple Heart. But this whole thing about when they're taking you back to get medical attention, that you thought about jumping out of the plane. You really thought your extra weight was going to cost the crew?
Well, as I say, I was kind of out of my head. And I was thinking, if I jump out, it'll make it easier for them to get back to England. So I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors. But the engineer, as I say, took my parachute off, the chest pack parachute, off me, and so I couldn't jump. I did have enough sense not to jump without a parachute, that's one. So, So I did get back to the radio room there.
But you were moments away, perhaps, from doing that, and I know you had 7 children, and now you have 6 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren, so I know they're all thankful you didn't jump out there. But you're still blind and wounded. You know the plane's in trouble because you've been shot up. So what was the rest of that mission like for you until they got you to the ground?
Well, we were back in the radio room. I don't recall too much about it. We flew back, and then we got in a sitting position. When you're going to make a crash landing, we thought there were no brakes, so we had to make a crash landing. And the pilot and the co-pilot and the I think the engineer were the only ones that could were doing their job. The rest of us all were sitting up against the wall in the radio room in case the plane, you know, we were backs to the wall of the radio room facing the front. Mm-hmm. And then I'd sit here, and then somebody sit next to him, in front of me, and then somebody in front of him. So we'd make it as easy as we could if we if we crashed. I mean, if we...
You're pretty much bracing for impact. And what's going on in your head? Are you clenching your teeth? You saying a prayer?
No, it didn't bother me a bit because, as I say, I was really out of it. You know? Uh-huh. So, no, what's new? So we made crash landing.
Yeah, no big deal, right? It just blows me away sometimes how unassuming the veterans who tell their stories on Hometown Heroes really are. It's break time again. If you want to see what Duke O'Donnell looks like today, or even check out a video pointing out the plexiglass souvenir he's still carrying around under his skin, you can check out the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And since I'm suggesting things for you to do, I know it might be hard for some of you listening in places like Albuquerque or Salem, Oregon, but if you're catching the show on one of our many Hometown Heroes affiliates in the state of California, how about heading to the very center of the state on October 21st to welcome home about 70 World War II veterans from their honor flight to the National World War II Memorial. They're going to land at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California at about 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, October 21st. And I know nothing would give them more goosebumps than stepping out to the biggest red, white, and blue crowd they've ever seen. There's an awesome air museum there, too, and you could go look at an authentic World War II B-17 bomber. Look at the nose. Imagine being Duke O'Donnell sitting up there. Anyway, that's October 21st at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater. I'll be there. I hope you can be there, too. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Tonight because of the name of our teams or of our schools.
Witness the true story.
But because of the name
of a spiritual awakening
above all names
that saved a high school.
Jesus.
And shook a city.
Look at the changes to these boys own.
Experience one hope, one truth, one way. Woodlawn.
I'm asking you to stand up and make a decision to change, to forgive, to choose Jesus.
I want you to stop all of these activities until this board has taken this matter under full review.
Nobody out there knows what's happened with this team. But when you win on this day, they will! This is what happens when God shows up.
Woodlawn. Now showing.